they realized that any referendum held in transparent and free conditions would lead to the independence of Western Sahara. Now, what are the prospects today? As you have already mentioned, Morocco has rebelled against the United Nations authority, expelled the major or the entire civilian component, and that says something about the Morocco's mood, because, as you know, it's the civilian component that was charged with organizing the referendum. And there's also a very central issue that you have already talked about, which is the human rights monitoring. Morocco fears that the United Nations may, and that's what we hope and that's what we've been calling for, a mandate may also to monitor the human rights situation. But with the absence of any civilians on the ground, that would be definitely difficult. So the question is, one of the United Nations, especially the Security Council, recovering and restoring its...
Ambassador Sidi Omar, we're going to have to leave it there. I'm so sorry. And also condolences. Stephen Zunis, professor at the University of San Francisco. That does it for our show. Special thanks to Maria Carrion, Democracy Now!'s two full-time job openings, news producer and office coordinator. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to KBOO Portland, 90.7 FM. The time is 5 o'clock. That means the news is next.
KBOO Community Radio is proud to welcome the Golden Rule Peace Boat to Portland, Wednesday, June 8th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church in Portland. In 1958, a crew of Quaker peace activists attempted to sail the Golden Rule to the Marshall Islands to interfere with U.S. nuclear bomb testing. This bold, nonviolent direct action inspired a worldwide movement leading to the Partial Nuclear Test Ban Treaty of 1963. On June 8th, there will be a panel presentation and discussion of their past work and plans for a peaceful, sustainable future, featuring Harvey Wasserman of Solartopia, Mimi German of The Radcast, Teresa Rayford from Don't Shoot Portland, and many more. Music will be provided by Dave Rovix. Again, that's the Golden Rule Peace Boat panel discussion on Wednesday, June 8th at 7 p.m. at the First Unitarian Church, 1011 Southwest 12th Avenue in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Tony Ozier and the Doodoo Funk All-Stars are teaming up with KBOO and Audio Globe to celebrate the 7th anniversary of Dookie Jam, June 2nd at Dante's, 3rd and Burnside in downtown Portland. Dookie Jam happens once a month with Tony Ozier and the Doodoo Funk All-Stars. Some of the best funk, rock, soul musicians from around the region get down and play live. KBOO is going to team up with Audio Globe, and we're going to stream that on kboo.fm. Audio Globe is an audio-video recording company that specializes in high-fidelity capture and streaming services, providing a global reach to regional and local artists on audioglobe.com. Look out for the Dookie Jam, live on kboo.fm as well as audioglobe.com, once a month, happening at Dante's.
This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from The Art of Living, presenting Get Happy Portland, a two-day immersive experience of breathing techniques and meditation by global humanitarian Sri Sri Ravi Shankar. Get Happy Portland takes place July 5th and 6th at the Oregon Convention Center. Tickets and information at gethappyportland.org.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Well, it's not just lead. It turns out that Portland Public Schools have now announced that several schoolrooms in the district exceed the EPA safe limits for radon gas.
And officials in Clark County say all of last week's three church fires in Vancouver area were arson.
Tourism is down in the Gaza Strip after a decade of closed borders and intermittent warfare.
Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Thursday, June 2nd, 2016. I'm Jenny Yokoyama.
And I'm Robert Barncord. Late last night, Portland Public Schools announced that it had found elevated levels of radon in some of its buildings. Facilities Director David Hobbs sent a memo to the board on Wednesday after receiving test results, and the board notified families and the press at 10:30 p.m. The test detected radon in 121 rooms, including 9 rooms that exceed the EPA's higher action level. Those 9 rooms were found in Meek, Beaumont, Whitman, Roseway Heights, Lent, and Marysville schools. The district took measures to mitigate radon in schools back in 2001, but the recent test was only done in response to legislation requiring that all schools should be tested by the year 2021. Radon is a radioactive, colorless, odorless gas that seeps into buildings and is held there. It originates from the soil beneath the buildings. Radon in high concentrations has been strongly linked to lung cancer, causing around 21,000 deaths each year. Only cigarettes cause more deaths from lung cancer. The district plans to do follow-up tests, including urgent short-term tests of the 9 rooms where high levels were found. Portland Public School System and its superintendent, Carol Smith, have been under fire for the entire past week for failing to notify families of high lead levels in school drinking water.
In the wake of Portland Public Schools' drinking water scandal, other school districts in the area are scrambling to check their lead levels. The Beaverton School District announced today that it will test drinking water at all 51 of its schools for lead. The district plans to contract with an outside firm for the testing by this Friday. The EPA limits acceptable lead levels in drinking water to 15 parts per billion. This is higher than in other countries, for example, in Canada, where the limit is 10 parts per billion. 2 Beaverton school drinking fountains were tested in late May after students complained of discolored water. Both were found to be in excess of the EPA's safe level by several parts per billion. The school's water fountains were shut off and bottled water provided to all students and staff, a marked contrast to the behavior of Portland schools officials. PPS officials have come under heavy fire from the community after it was revealed last week that tests done 8 weeks ago found lead levels as high as twice the EPA limit. Nobody in the community was notified and no actions were taken for weeks after the tests came back. The Catholic Archdiocese of Portland also announced yesterday that it would test all of its schools in the area.
And Portland, Oregon, and Flint, Michigan are not the only places where lead testing is a debacle. According to documents received by The Guardian, lead testing seems scandalous across the entire United States. KABU reporter Emery Mort has more.
Documents from 80 of the largest U.S. cities, towns, and states east of the Mississippi show that over the past decade, 33 of them have been using techniques that cheat lead tests. Take Philadelphia, where a lead testing class action lawsuit was filed against the city today. Reporting shows Philadelphia used 3 methods against the order of EPA regulators. Each of the methods is designed to ensure that lead in water consumed by children and adults doesn't show up on the test. First, they recommended that lead testers pre-flush their pipes. Second, they recommended testers remove the aeration device at the tap where lead accumulates. Third, they recommended testers run the water slowly to ensure a minimum amount of lead shows up on the test. 3 cheating methods, 1 aim. Avoid detecting lead. Documents show that while Jacksonville, Florida hasn't used any cheating methods over the past decade, Boston, Massachusetts used 2 methods that could deceive its population, and Milwaukee, Wisconsin limited itself to 1. Other disturbing details include Chicago and Philadelphia officials ordering employees to test water safety in their own homes. The states of Michigan and New Hampshire told their water testers to give themselves extra time for testing so that any results over the federal safety limit could be removed and resampled. Like in other instances, the EPA regulators are not blameless. Their recommendations were not properly policed or enforced, The Guardian reports. Lack of federal oversight permitted state agencies in Rhode Island and Maine to continue to recommend pre-flushing pipes for years after the EPA rules were updated. An outrage is the expression Mark Edwards used to describe the findings. Edwards is the scientist who discovered the water travesty in Flint, Michigan that has so far led to the arrest of 3 government employees in the state. This is Emery Mort with KABU News.
3 Vancouver churches with 3 different orientations were set ablaze in a 5-day span last week. Authorities in Clark County are now saying that the fires were set by one arsonist or a group of arsonists. The fires were set last week on Wednesday, Thursday, and Sunday at churches merely miles apart. No suspects have been apprehended or publicly identified. The Federal Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms and Explosives has joined with various policing and fire departments from Vancouver City and Clark County in a coordinated investigation. The task force of federal and local agencies is now offering more money, up to $20,000, for information leading to the arrest and conviction of responsible parties. Authorities have asked area churches to review surveillance footage and have asked the public to report suspicious activity linked to possible fires. The Clark County Sheriff's Office has a tip line and email for those who might have tips on the three suspected crimes. If you want that tip line number, here it is, so grab a pen. That number is 877-CRIME-11. That's 877-CRIME-11. The email for tips is ccsomcu@gmail.com. Again, that's ccsomcu@gmail.com.
Officials issued arrest warrants for 47 protesters who participated in the demonstrations that occurred in Ferguson, Missouri in August of 2014. Although the prospective defendants were arrested by city police at the time for a failure to comply with an order to disperse, the municipal ordinance was actually deemed unconstitutional back in the 80s, so the agency bringing the charges now is St. Louis County. The charges themselves have also been revised. The protesters are now being charged with interfering with a police officer while in the performance of duty. The county had charged two reporters who were among those arrested, but those charges were dropped when the journalists promised not to take any legal action.
Portland city officials admit taxpayers paid a premium when forking over $35 million for a desperately needed property near the PDX airport. The exact answer as to why the city paid so much is proving hard to provide. In short, developer Trammell Crowe bought the 47-acre property for $6 million in 2014. The Oregonian released an estimate that the property, tagged to house a U.S. Postal Service center, is now worth between $17 and $20 million. The city is now awaiting an appraisal to determine the current value of the building. The city had initially planned on getting an appraisal, but the Oregonian dug into the complicated sale agreement and suggested back in January that the city might reconsider. It's now increasingly clear that the Portland Development Commission has dragged its feet on ordering and reporting on the appraisal they said would be in the works starting in early March. The U.S. Postal Service spokesperson says that it has an appraisal, but won't release it. Portland officials say their appraisal may be ready by mid-June.
Portland's Dougie Center offers a kaleidoscope of services to traumatized youth and their families. Tomorrow night, they're throwing a great big benefit event in Northeast Portland. And here at KBOO to talk with us about this are Brandon, a past participant in the program and the executive director of Dougie Center. Brandon, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having us. We appreciate it.
So first of all, talk a little bit about the Dougie Center so our listeners can figure out what it is that you do, what your mission is.
Absolutely. We provide peer support to grieving kids. So kids who've had a mom, dad, brother, or sister die come together with kids around their same age who've experienced a similar death in their family. We've been providing support services here in Portland since 1982 and have served over 35,000 grieving children and their families here in Portland and the surrounding area.
That's a lot. That's 35 years, so that's about 1,000 people a year.
Yeah, we typically do provide about that. Right now, we have over 500 kids, teens, young adults, and that come per month, and then we have about 350 of their adult family members who also participate in support programs.
And are there other reasons besides a death in the family that cause grieving and that you address?
Well, certainly, grief obviously happens for a lot of different reasons in this world, and we primarily provide support services after a death. However, we also have a Pathways program that is a new program to the Dougie Center that provides support to families when they have a family member that's been diagnosed with an advanced serious illness. So someone who may be getting closer to the end of their life and is looking for support services for themselves and their families.
And when you talk to people, to the general public about this, do you have any sort of suggestions about what we can do or what we should be aware of?
Absolutely. I think that one of the things that's, you know, we're aware of organizationally is that death can be a really tough subject matter for people to talk about. Oftentimes it's a kind of a taboo subject matter. And what we hear over and over again from our families is that they want the opportunity to remember the person in their family who's died. They want the opportunity to share memories and share stories and to really have a rich relationship with that person, even though that person is no longer alive. So what we suggest to people is to reach out to those who have had someone in their family die, to talk about the person, to ask them questions. Oftentimes you don't get enough opportunity to share memories. So instead of not knowing what to say, sometimes we can say, gee, I don't know what to say, but do you want to tell me about them? If you knew the person, you can always share a memory yourself. And oftentimes families will say that they're always thinking about the person who died. And it's those people who aren't afraid to talk about it with them that they really appreciate in the aftermath of a death.
What have you found to be the most challenging aspects of dealing with it yourself at the Dougie Center?
Yeah, well, I have been on staff at the Dougie Center for the last 12 years. I actually was a participant myself. I came through the program when I was 12 years old in 1987 after the death of my mother. And what I found was a safe haven at the Dougie Center, and that it was really my only place that I could truly express what I was going through and get the support that I needed. I then volunteered as a teenager, and I left Portland for a lot of years, and I came back 12 years ago to work at the Dougie Center because of the impact that it had in my life. Of course, there are challenges in working at the Dougie Center. There's challenges in hearing the stories and being present with folks who are grieving, but I often think about how different my life would have been if the Dougie Center hadn't existed. And that is really what keeps me going and keeps me motivated to do the work that I do at the Dougie Center.
I see. And Brendan, what's happening tomorrow night with this event?
So for my senior project, I go to Trillium Charter School. I decided that I wanted to do a benefit for the Dougie Center because of the impact that it had on my life, for me going through the program when I was six, and then again when I was 16 or 17. And so tomorrow it's called Music and Fashion in Bloom, and it's a concert, a fashion show, and a silent auction. And we will have one of the winners of Portland Idol there, Danielle Ward, and a famous guitarist, singer there named Matt Alber. We'll also have various other performers who are performing, and we have had some really great donations for the silent auction given, and so, yeah, I'm really excited. And tickets are $15.
Okay, very good, very good. So could either of you share some success stories from the Dougie Center? They're inspiring kind of stories?
Well, I would like to just point out that having a past participant like Brandon come back to the Dougie Center to provide support to other kids, to me, is a huge success story when we organizationally have impacted someone's life in such a way that when they have the opportunity to do a senior project and they decide that they want to provide support to other grieving children and teens, that to me shows that the Dougie Center is really having an impact in people's lives. We have a large volunteer force. We couldn't do what we do without our volunteers, and a large percentage of our volunteers are past participants. They either came themselves as a young person or they were an adult who brought a child to the Dougie Center. And to me, that really shows just the impact that the Dougie Center has on people's lives every day.
And do you have a vision for the future, some goals for...
Absolutely. Yeah, I do. I have a lot of really wonderful, opportunities currently as well as in the future. The biggest thing for us right now in this moment is really reducing the amount of families that we have waiting for the Dougie Center and reducing the amount of time that families wait. As I mentioned, we're serving about 500 kids and about 350 adult family members a month. And we've recently increased our services over the last 3 years by about 25%. However, at any given moment, we have currently right around 50 kids waiting for our program. So for me, the immediate need is really capacity building and expansion so that we can serve more kids and families and serve them more quickly. That's the most immediate need. And then into the future, there's a lot of opportunity for growth here in the Portland area. There are over 500 programs across the country and around the world that are based on the Dougie Center model. And I think that that shows that there's just a need in this community and around the world for what the Dougie Center provides.
Volunteers. So in what ways can our listeners support your work? Volunteering is obvious, but what other ways?
Absolutely. Well, the Dougie Center is always looking for volunteers. We ask that our volunteers complete our training and commit to a year of service to the Dougie Center in order to work directly with the kids and families, but we always have other additional volunteer opportunities as well. We always are in the need. We have a wish list on our website, and of course, donations are always welcome. We do provide opportunities for one-off volunteer experiences. We always need stuffed animals and art supplies and snacks for the kids. So there's always opportunities that people can support us, for people to support us, and those are available on our website, or of course, you can always call the Dougie Center to find out more.
And are you having any other events besides this big one tomorrow?
Well, we just completed a large fundraiser in May that the Dougie Center put on that was very successful. It was the most successful one we've had in our history, which is exciting. And we raffle off a Porsche Boxster every year. The winning ticket was drawn in May. So we'll start selling tickets again for that in November or December. We have a fall event and look for community support for that. And we have more information on our website around those events as well. We have a couple things going on this summer as well. So lots of exciting stuff happening for the Dougie Center right now.
Well, this has been a really great thing to learn about. And I want to thank Brandon for coming in, and Brennan, the executive director.
Thank you.
This is the Dougie Center that we've been talking about. You can find more about the work they do at www.dougy.org. Thanks again.
Thank you.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned for KBOO News in Depth at 5:45, featuring journalist Ken Bilderback on the history of law and order in Forest Grove, followed by Rose City Native Radio at 6. At 7, it's Ear to the Streets of Portland, featuring Coach RJ, who will talk about the emotional clutter in our lives, and author Sharon Blake on her new book, The Thought Detox. Tomorrow's weather will be hot and getting hotter, with a high of 88 rising to 101 degrees on Saturday. Tomorrow's low will be 61 degrees. Today in history, the Portland Rum Riot occurred in our namesake of Portland, Maine in 1855. The manufacture and sale of alcohol had been illegal in Maine since 1851, which the local immigrant Irish community viewed as a measure targeted against them. When Portland mayor and staunch teetotaler Neil Dow approved a shipment of alcohol into Portland in 1855 for use by medical facilities, a riot broke out over the perceived hypocrisy. Dow called in the state militia, and one man was killed and seven injured. Fallout from the riot led to the repeal of the liquor law 1 year later. The quote of the day is from Will Rogers, who said, "Why don't they pass a constitutional amendment prohibiting anybody from learning anything? If it works as well as prohibition did, in 5 years, Americans would be the smartest race of people on earth." ¶¶
Get ready, Portland. Naked biking is coming back. Organizers of the World Naked Bike Ride, the global event that draws about 10,000 nude bikers here to Portland every year, have announced that the 2016 race will begin in Southeast Portland on the evening of June 25th. Mount Scott Park will be the gathering place for the swarm of naked bikers who will follow an unannounced route through the city. The ride was created back in 2003 by Canadian activist Conrad Schmidt. He said that it was a protest against our dependence on oil and to make people aware of bikers on the road and to help keep them protected. Riders will also strip to promote body positivity or to take up a reason of their own. So prepare yourself, whether you're riding or not, because the naked bikers are coming.
The first ride was right around bike summer, and there's a lot of lore about whether it kicked off during bike summer or if people were biking around naked before then.
And bike summer's kind of the precursor to what became Pedalpalooza.
Exactly.
Okay.
And so, you know, today actually I reached out to a bunch of the people who were around in 2002, as was I. And we all kind of agree that those years are a little hazy for us now. So we're certain that people were riding naked in 2002, but the first time that anybody really took the time to count how many riders there were wasn't until 2004. And then by 2005, the World Naked Bike Ride in Portland was mainly a nighttime ride, although there's always been daytime rides as well. So the official World Naked Bike Ride in Portland is a nighttime ride. We have a lot of other spin-off rides that are really great to happen during the day.
So if you can't make it out at night or you work at night, you can still join in on the fun in the daylight. That are in those, some of those rides are a little bit shorter. Some of them are in the forest, I think. So you have a lot of choices to choose from. But a lot of people might think like naked and bike riding and associate that with words like titillating or crazy or even dangerous. But 10,000 people are known to show up each year. What do you think makes that ride so attractive and inclusive? I mean, these aren't just like hardcore cyclists or hardcore nudists, right?
Right. A lot of people have never been naked in the public, and a lot of people have to dust off their bike from years past that they've ridden. So I think, you know, we've done a lot of talking with other World Naked Bike Rides around the globe. And I think one of the things that we really have going for us is the fact that our ride is in the evening. I think people feel a little comfort in the cloak of darkness. And I think that, you know, for a while our ride was doubling every year. And we kind of, it seems like we've capped out at 10,000 riders, which is a really phenomenal number.
The recent debate over a local Portland restaurant that celebrates colonialism has grown into a wider discussion about the lives of people of color live in the whitest city in the United States. Placing himself on the front line of this discussion is Stevie Elipan, who plans to travel to his family's home in Puerto Rico across the country to eliminate issues of imperialism, colonialism, racism, and more. Stevie's with us live in Studio 2 tonight. Thanks for being here, Stevie.
Oh, thank you for having me here.
First of all, let's just talk about your trip. Where are you traveling to and why?
Well, I am traveling back home to my island of Boriquen, but as Americans like to call it, Puerto Rico. That's the colonized name of it. And I'm going to be traveling throughout the island and the outer islands, Culebra and Vieques. Why I'm going back is, one, reconnect with my people after 5 years away. And living among you all and living in the heart of the empire, or at least in the white homeland section of the empire. I just feel it's time to go back. And it's also a chance for me to build relationships with local organizations there that are anti-colonial, anti-capitalism, resistance of American occupation. And I want to be writing about life living under a U.S. colony. I feel like the citizens of, you know, this empire of thieves and slavers don't really understand what a colony is and that they have colonies.
I was talking about in the intro that restaurant Saffron Colonial,
and it's stirred such emotions here in this city. So I'm wondering, what do you wish that white people and all people all from in this area, what do you wish that they knew about colonialism and imperialism?
Boy, I wish that they knew that citizens of empires, people that benefit from empires, are very proud of their empires. Everybody in this country, especially white European settlers, if you talk to them about American imperialism, they'll either laugh it off or talk about it as a serious thing, but they all agree that this is an empire. What they won't talk about are the colonies. People in empires are not proud of their colonies. They're in denial about it. They don't even want to know it exists. And so they just kind of sit in this willful ignorance of colonies and even the borders of, you know, the mainland of their country.
Well, can you talk about Puerto Rico specifically? What is going on there right now that is drawing you there?
It's what's been going on for about 500 years. But the U.S. got involved in 1898 after the Spanish-American War and decided to be the new masters of our island, or so they think for now. What's going on right there is with the economic crisis and a $72 billion debt that we're expected to pay, although it's really been created by American imperialism, we have 5,000 people leaving every year. I think in 2000, we were 4 million. Now we're 3.5 million. That's 500,000 people that might not ever come back to the island. We have people that are losing their homes. I think it's 11 people a day lose their homes to foreclosure. And there's not a lot of places to go. You know, it's an island. It's only 100 miles wide and 100 miles long, 30 miles wide. And that's not including the outer islands, Culebra and Vieques, of course. A lot of it's being bought up by the military-industrial complex, the United States military, federal government, private companies like the you know, the Hiltons. They own quite a bit of land there and mostly the shoreline. And yeah, there's, you know, they're tightening the belt on us. The fiscal board has even proposed to bringing down our minimum wage, which is already at $7.25, to $4.25 for people under 25 years of age for at least the first 3 months that they're employed. Keep in mind, not everybody, I, at least growing up as being part of the working poor in Borinquen, getting 40 hours was almost impossible. And you can hardly make a living off of that. It's very expensive living on that island. $4.20 for people that are students, young, working, and also helping to support their own family, they're not going to be able to make it. So what's going to happen is they're going to end up leaving. So we're going to lose an entire generation of people and all that labor and all that knowledge and all those skills and all that talent. We're going to be losing it to the U.S., which is probably pay them less. Some of those people are going to end up joining United States military, which we've always been doing for the last 100 years, because if, you know, it's the most stable option for us economically. Like it's at least that's what we're told, that you get free college, you're going to get housing, you're going to be taken care of. But we all know that's not true, because if you go to the VA hospital in Puerto Rico, you're going to see a lot of people that are injured and regret having served. They're paying the price now. Even the testing of Agent Orange was done in Puerto Rico. And then the soldiers that we sent out on the U.S., actually, we didn't send them out. They got drafted, get sent out to Vietnam. And then they, enforcing imperial rule and helping with the colonization of Vietnam or the attempted colonization of Vietnam by the Americans, they get a second dose of Agent Orange. So we're all paying for all that. And that's not going to end. It's just getting worse, especially if we keep joining National Guard and the United States military and even the Border Patrol.
Well, this is definitely a topic that we could unpack forever. The different colonies in the United States that, mm-hmm. you know, our mainstream society doesn't seem to even like to use that word when it comes to the United States. So it's really interesting that you've decided to draw attention to this. So who is partnering with you on this trip?
Well, KBOO has been kind enough to give me a platform during the next few months that I'm going to be out on the island. I've been getting a lot of help and support and advice from the All African People's Revolutionary Party, from the Maryland Buck Abolitionist Collective, and my comrades in the Portland Committee for Human Rights in the Philippines. I've been very helpful in supporting and communicating my project and giving me advice on how to go about it best.
Can you expand a little bit about here when you say that KABU is partnering with you, does this mean that we're going to be able to follow along as you're on this journey and you will be reporting back to us?
Certainly. Once I leave after July 1st, I'm going to be sending audio recordings of interviews and events on the island. I'm trying to get there in time to talk about July 4th, the 4th of July, or the 4th of July, as some of my comrades like to call it, and talk about the celebrations or lack of celebration of the American Independence Day while I'm out there. And I use American Independence Day very loosely because it was only independence for a few.
Well, how long will you be out there and doing this project for?
I plan on staying out there until November 10th. I'd like to be present for the November 8th elections, which happen to be the United States elections for the president. Although we are not participating in the presidential elections, like we have not done so for as long as we've been part of the United States, we still talk about it quite a bit. It is a big issue.
Well, you know, we are running out of time here, but I want to make sure that people know how they can support your work. So I know that you have a blog. Can you give us that address?
Yes, the blog is called Balante, but it's on Blogger and it's called I Will Not Obey. So I Will Not Obey /Blogger. You can also follow me on Facebook at Stevie Elepan, E-L-E-P-A-N. You all can also follow me on Twitter at Stevie Elepan. And also I have a GoFundMe coming up and it's called Through My Own Eyes. And also on the 17th of November, there is a Zumba fundraiser hosted by a comrade of mine, Amaru from the AAPRP. So it's $10 per person and it'll be worth it just to see me flail about and keep up with the rest of the crowd.
Well, thank you very much, Stevie, for coming in. We look forward to hearing your reporting here on KABU. So please, everybody, turn in to that website. Once again, let's hear that blogspot or the blogger where they can hear your reporting.
The blogger is I Will Not Obey, but the title of the blog itself is Balante. You can also track it down on my Facebook. I'm always posting it, Stevie Elepan on Facebook.
Okay, thank you for coming in, Stevie.
Thank you.
On Thursday, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, known as the CFPB, released a proposal for the first ever federal regulations pertaining to the payday lending industry. The CFPB was set up back in 2010 in the wake of the financial crisis as a watchdog agency for consumers here in the U.S. FSRN's Robert Packard has more.
The payday loan industry in the United States may soon be changing thanks to new regulations proposed by the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, or the CFPB. The proposed regulations are, in the words of the CFPB, quote, aimed at ending payday debt traps. About 12 million U.S. residents take out payday loans and other similar short-term high-interest loans each year, frequently to cover daily living expenses. According to the Center for Responsible Lending, these so-called predatory loans can carry annual interest rates of 400% or higher. Consumer advocates criticize the industry for creating a cycle of debt, with borrowers often having to renew their loans for a fee or taking out a new one shortly after repaying the first. Morris Pearl is the chairperson of the Patriotic Millionaires, a group of more than 200 U.S.-based millionaires who support legislation to lessen the country's income inequality. He says there is incentive for lenders to make loans they know can't be paid back.
What they do is they make loans with they have no expectation of ever being repaid, but they make a profit because they charge such high fees and interest rates on the loans. Even though the person never actually finishes paying off the loan, it can still be a profitable loan for the lender.
The CFPB's proposal would, if enacted, require lenders to verify a customer's income and confirm they can repay the debt on time. It would also reduce the number of times a customer is allowed to roll an old loan into a new one or to take out consecutive loans. This is not the first time the CFPB has indicated its desire to regulate the payday loan industry, having announced it was considering potential proposals in 2015. The regulations could go into effect as soon as next year and would not require congressional or other approval, though a period for public comment on the rules will be open through September 14th. Robert Packard, FSRN, Charlottesville, Virginia.
And now, the latest news and developments from
the occupied territories in Palestine from the International Middle East Media Center in Bethlehem.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center at www.imemc.org for Wednesday, June 1st, 2016. Two Palestinians injured, more than 50 others kidnapped by Israeli troops in the West Bank. Meanwhile, tanks destroy farmlands in Gaza. These stories and more coming up. Stay tuned. Israeli soldiers shot and injured on Tuesday at night two Palestinians in Qalqilya in the northern part of the occupied West Bank. Media sources in the city said that several military vehicles invaded it late at night before the soldiers stormed and searched few homes and interrogated many Palestinians. The invasion led to clashes with many local youth who hurled stones and empty bottles on the military vehicles while the army fired rubber-coated steel bullets and gas bombs. Medical sources said that two Palestinians were shot with rubber-coated steel bullets and many others suffered the effects of tear gas inhalation. In the meantime, Israeli soldiers invaded on Wednesday at dawn the Suwana neighborhood and a Tur town in occupied East Jerusalem, stormed and ransacked dozens of homes and kidnapped 45 Palestinians, including several children, the Wadi Hilwa Information Center in Silwan, Silwanik, said. Lawyer Mohammed Mahmoud said that soldiers moved most of the kidnapped Palestinians to the police station in Salah al-Din Street in Jerusalem. Moreover, Israeli soldiers kidnapped on Wednesday at dawn six Palestinians in the southern West Bank district of Hebron and four others in Tobas in the northeastern part of the West Bank. In the Gaza Strip, several armored Israeli military vehicles and bulldozers invaded on Wednesday morning Palestinian agricultural lands close to the border fence in the southern and central parts of the coastal region. In addition, six armored military vehicles, including four tanks, advanced more than 150 meters into agricultural lands east of Deir al-Balah in central Gaza and bulldozed Palestinian farmlands while surveillance drones hovered overhead. The vehicles fired several live rounds at random, media sources in Khan Yunis had reported. They also came from the Kisufim military base. And that's all for today from the IMEMC News. This was a Wednesday, June 1st, 2016 news roundup from the occupied Palestinian territories. For more news and updates, please visit our website at www.imemc.org. Today's report has been brought to you by George Mau and me, Ghassan Bannoura.
You are listening to the KABU Evening News. This is a volunteer-produced newscast. We do encourage your participation. You can call us right here with your breaking news stories at 503-231-8032. Ask for extension 203. Our production team for tonight's newscast is Natasha Delapine, Emery Mort, Robin Ryan, and Sam Talner. The producer is Sam Bowman. Special thanks to our friends at Free Speech Radio News. Our engineer in there with a whip is Matthew Olson. The KABU Evening News and Public Affairs Director is Lisa Loving. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You can also find us on Facebook and Twitter at KABU News. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Robert Barncord.
And I'm Jenny Yokoyama. Coming up tomorrow morning on KABU. At 7, it's Democracy Now! With Amy Goodman and Juan Gonzalez. At 8, it's Ania and Lynn with their hosting Positively Revolting Talk Radio, a variety of topics from an eco-feminist and anarcho-feminist perspective. At 9, we speak with psychology professor Dacher Keltner about his book, The Power Paradox, How We Gain and Lose Influence. At 9:30, we speak with Douglas Sow of the Portland Underground Graduate School about upcoming events. At 10, it's Air Cascadia, headlines, interviews, and commentary with Chris Andre. At 10:15, it's Flashpoints, investigative news radio with Dennis Bernstein. At 11, host Jean Bradley interviews writer Nathaniel Philbrick about his new book, Valiant Ambition, George Washington, Benedict Arnold, and the Fate of the American Revolution. And at 11:30 on Progressive Spirit, host John Shuck speaks with leading Hinduism scholar Wendy Doniger about her book, Redeeming the Kama Sutra. Thanks, KABU members, for your ongoing support for KABU Radio. Not a current supporter? You can become one by going to kboo.fm and clicking on Donate. Good night, Robert.
Good night, Jenna. Good night, Matthew.
Good night.
KABU News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
When it came to statehood, the two major sticking points were slavery and prohibition. If you think about the early settlers of Oregon, they fell into two primary groups, very puritanical New Englanders, often missionaries, on one side, but then you also had hard-drinking, hard-living southern trappers and farmers and that sort of thing who came from Missouri and Arkansas and Kentucky and places like that. And so they all arrived here in Oregon, tried to form a government, very different ideas about slavery and race. And the slavery issue was settled by the federal government because of the Missouri Compromise and a number of other things. Oregon could not enter the state as a slave state, so the Southerners officially excluded free black people. At the end of the Civil War, for example, Oregon was not a slave state, but it was the only state that still had written into its constitution that you could not legally live here if you were black. And the last of that, those black exclusion laws, by the way, didn't go off the books until the 1920s. But the other issue the federal government left alone, and that was prohibition. And prohibition carried the day when the territory was formed.